Nature versus nurture.
Fundamentally, if you look at what intelligence is, it's an accumulation of skills. And this idea that we're each born with a certain IQ level that was just kind of right in our genes, and there's nothing we're going to do to change that, that's just fundamentally wrong.
That's journalist David Shank. We'll talk to him about his book, The Genius in All of Us. It's about what the new science of epigenetics is teaching us about the potential for human achievement.
He just sort of said, I don't wish nobody to have a life like mine. And at first it sounds like sort of a bitter statement, but I was always struck by this kid's compassion. And there was this element of, he knew it was bad, and he just didn't want people to have to go through the kinds of things that he had gone through.
And that's David Chura, talking about one of his students when he was teaching adolescent inmates in jail. His book is I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Child prodigies like Yo-Yo Ma and Mozart, or in sports, Tiger Woods, are born, not made, right? They just got lucky in the genetic lottery, while the rest of us have to be satisfied with mediocrity, or, at best, the modest achievements we can reach by dint of hard work. Not so fast, says David Shank in his new book, The Genius in All of Us. He says everything we've been told about genetics, talent, and IQ are wrong. Shank says new science is showing that great achievement isn't about what's in the genes. It's about how the environment influences genetic information, and that information can be changed by dedication, practice, and ambition. Shank is a best-selling author of 5 previous books, including The Forgetting and Data Smog. He's written for The Atlantic, National Geographic, Slate, Harper's, and other venues. David Shank, in your book, The Genius of All of Us, you go up against what's probably the dominant paradigm that we have today in the thinking about nature versus nurture, and that is the idea that genes really determine much of how we are, how we behave, and what's going to happen to us, and particularly our intelligence. You take a different view. Explain to us, what is the perspective that drives your book?
Well, I'm taking the interpretation that science takes a very different view, actually, which is, and unfortunately, there's now a huge gulf between what scientists now understand about genetics and talent and intelligence and what the public is still kind of left to understand with old myths and misunderstandings. The essential message of my book is not that genes don't influence us tremendously. Genes, we obviously all have genetic differences, and genes are very influential. But they really don't determine, strictly speaking, anything about us. And it's important to understand several different pieces of science to know that really intelligence and all manner of our abilities are much more about a process than they are a specific thing. The idea of innate intelligence or innate musical ability or innate athletic ability really does not fit with our current understanding of biology, nor does it fit with our understanding of how people get good at stuff. It turns out that science can now help explain all these things to us, starting with a whole new understanding of genes and then moving on to a whole new understanding of the development, the very slow development of skills that end up becoming all sorts of different abilities.
Yeah, and you say a whole new understanding. Part of this understanding comes under the rubric of epigenetics. Explain to us the difference between genetics and epigenetics.
Well, epigenetics can actually mean a couple of different things, but basically the epigenome is the covering of the gene. It's the stuff that wraps around a gene, and the key part here is that while our genes get passed down unchanged from parent to child, the epigenome can actually change. It's affected by the environment and by all sorts of different things. And the reason that's so important is that genes don't actually have strict instructions for what our traits are supposed to be. They actually don't have strict instructions for what your eye color is going to be and how tall you're going to be and you know whether you're going to be athletic or musical. They do have instructions. They have instructions for how proteins should be built. And, of course, different genes are going to influence different things in different directions. But the key point here is that actually genes get turned on and off by signals outside the cell and by elements in the epigenome. So there's all sorts of different things that can affect what we call gene expression. So we need to move away from the old idea of genes being this blueprint with very, very specific information about what color your eyes are going to be and how smart you're going to be and all that stuff, and toward a place where actually genes themselves and genes giving us our abilities actually is also a process. We can't entirely control that process, of course, but we can understand it better and we actually can impact it.
Can you give us an example?
Examples are everywhere. The musical ability is not something that you're born with from a couple of genes. Musical ability is something that is developed. It's probably influenced very, very early on and probably even inside the womb by your environment. How athletic you are is influenced from the very almost the very earliest moments of conception, but also on through your life. You can change your genetic expression through your activity, through your exercise. We actually change our biology in our brains and in genetic expression by the things that we do, the thoughts that we have, the stresses that we have in our life, the nutrition that we eat. That's why when you read in the newspaper that there's a gene that causes cancer in some people, but not all the people that have that gene, it's because that gene is getting expressed in a certain way in some of those people, but not getting expressed in that same way in those other people. And it's environmental factors that actually are a part of that gene expression.
You gave the example of music, and you have a wonderful section in your book, The Genius in All of Us, about Yo-Yo Ma. I mean, here is somebody who we would assume, you know, was in fact born with a certain talent, an inborn musical talent. He was a kind of prodigy already by the age of 3. And also, unlike many prodigies, as you point out, actually did go on to become quite successful in his career. Tell us about the case of him, and why does he prove your point rather than the point of those who say that it's all in the genes?
Right. Well, the understanding of genes proves the first part of that point, but the new understanding of genes. But Yo-Yo Ma, what you get when you look very closely at any extraordinary achiever is you can see that there's a process there. From far away, we see these guys fully mature playing extraordinary things on stage or playing basketball in this way that just looks magical and natural and just seems so far from our abilities that we must have some kind of explanation that just kind of fits in there. So we choose the genetic explanation because it fits with what we've been taught. But you look at Michael Jordan, you look at Tiger Woods, you look at Yo-Yo Ma, you look at any great achiever very closely, and what you see is a process. And in the case of Yo-Yo Ma, he was indeed born into a very musical world. He was born into a family that was already very, very musically advanced. Both his mother and his father were serious musicians and even professional musicians. His father had a dream, one big dream, and that was to create a child orchestra. So he wasn't just a professional musician. He didn't just teach music. He had a specific and very, very deeply developed interest in teaching young children how to be great at a musical instrument. And in the case of Yo-Yo Ma, which actually parallels the case of Mozart very closely, Yo-Yo Ma had an older sister who had kind of been almost the guinea pig of her father's teaching interests, you know, the first go-around. So when Yo-Yo Ma was born, he kind of was born into the trifecta. He had the parents who had just a deep interest in music. He had a household which was listening to music very, very closely from even moments before he was born. You know, even in the womb, he was hearing this stuff. He had an older sister who he could look up to, who basically, from the moment he was born, was already doing really interesting things musically. It was his world. It was his life from, you know, the moment he opened his eyes. And if you understand what that does to the brain and how the brain physically changes in response to how people hear music, about how they think about music, about how you're taught music very early on, it's actually not a surprise that Yo-Yo Ma turned out to be as extraordinary as he was. Of course, it was very, very difficult. Hard work, both early on and then to maintain that through his adolescence and to become an adult creator. That's all very, very tough. I don't want to minimize it. But in fact, when you look at it through the lens of my book, I'm giving more credit to these achievers because what they've achieved is been the process of their life. It wasn't something that was necessarily given to them, you know, in some kind of, you know, genetic computer chip before they were born.
So are you actually saying that if any of us had the kind of nurturing environment, musically nurturing environment that Yo-Yo Ma did, that we could in fact end up like Yo-Yo Ma? Or what is the role of genes?
Well, you know, some of these questions are simply unanswerable and always will be, but we have a lot of evidence that musical and other abilities are out there for the tapping if we expose ourselves to the right resources. One of the great examples of that is to look at, you know, the myth of Mozart and the myth of Yo-Yo Ma and how there's only these prodigies that, you know, only come along once every so often. And then to look at what Dr. Suzuki did in the 20th century, which is he kind of woke up one day and was like, this doesn't make sense. Kids learn very intricate languages very early on. There's no reason why they can't learn to play musical instruments with some sort of expert skill very early on. And he developed a whole teaching method. And lo and behold, we had, after just a number of years of him refining his techniques and spreading them around the world, we had thousands upon thousands upon thousands of very, very young, extraordinary performers developing into great achievers through this method of instruction. So I can't say that every single person has exactly the same, you know, innate musical ability or exactly the same potential. The point is, you don't know what your individual potential is until and unless you expose yourself to an extraordinary amount of resources, which means not just the right teachers and the time spent, but also sacrifices made in your life. You have to make a decision that many, many hours in the day and many, many days in the week and many, many months in the year over time, many years of your life will end up being spent on this one enterprise as opposed to having a more, you might call, balanced life or ordinary life or what have you. In the end, this becomes more about choices that we make, either knowingly or unknowingly, than it is about innate abilities.
I'm talking with David Shenk about his book, The Genius in All of Us. The subtitle is Why Everything You've Been Told About Genetics, Talent, and IQ is Wrong. So what did, in fact, draw you to this subject here? Is there a personal angle to it?
Well, sure there is. And I think that, you know, this is one of those subjects that everyone will bring a personal angle to. I mean, I've got several. One is I used to be a very ambitious violin player and was actually quite good when I was 11, 12, 13, and then kind of traded my interest in the violin for a number of other things and pretty much dropped off the violin map fairly quickly after that, once I stopped practicing my 90 minutes a day, which I did for several years. So I do have firsthand experience with seeing what intense, intense practice and dedication can do for a very specific skill. I'm also a parent, so I also have all these natural questions about, you know, how to inspire kids and how to try to teach kids the idea of developing an ambition for academically and in other ways. So lots of questions. The very specific inspiration for this book, though, came I guess about 5 or 6 years ago when I was in the middle of writing my last book, which is about the history of chess, in fact, and I was studying for a particular chapter the difference between mediocre chess players and really, really good chess players. And there's actually quite a bit of science on that now. And what I realized when I started reading the science was that it's not just about chess. There's a whole arena of science now called expertise studies, which has thousands of studies of what makes people good at stuff, the difference between the people who are mediocre and better than mediocre, and better than that, and better than that. And they just study every possible variable in practice and in movement. Obviously, the different studies depend on the different abilities and disciplines. But, they study every possible little variable there, and they're coming up with really, really interesting observations. And I thought, well, that could actually be a whole different book.
Is this some of what, for example, has made athletes continually break records?
Absolutely, and that really fits into the whole message of the book. You know, we look at the 20th century, now the 21st century, and we see that you can look at the runners and the swimmers and the bikers and any discipline, really, basketball players, anyone was better in the late 20th century than they were in the early, than the whole class of the people from that sport or that discipline in the early 20th century who were better than the ones before them in the 19th century, who were better than the ones for them in the 18th century. There's actually a couple of classical violin pieces, concertos, that were considered virtually unplayable when they were first written several hundred years ago, that are now routinely played well by many, many students of not just, you know, the best of the best, but just kind of aspiring students. And that's because overall we have, as a civilization, as a society, have learned how to get better at stuff. We're better teachers. We're better trainers. We learn from our history. We learn from our kind of accumulated experience. We develop better techniques. We figure out, in the case of swimming, you know, what the best stroke is, train for that, and how to, you know, what the best nutritional regimen is on our way to that training. So we learn all these different tricks which help us get better at stuff. There are so many techniques that in teaching and in training, regardless of discipline, that we can pick up and apply to becoming great at something if we so desire, if we have the will, if we have the discipline, if we have that incredible ambition.
The whole idea of genetics as being the determiner of a genius, of intelligence, has been very much linked to, I think we could call, racist ideas of human beings, of the whole idea that some people are smarter than others because by virtue of their race or their ethnic background. I wonder if you could talk to that and some of the new understandings that we have about race itself.
Yes, well, the original idea, the original modern idea of nature being the chief determiner of genes, really kind of determining our intelligence, goes back to Francis Galton, who invented the phrase nature versus nurture, who also invented the science of eugenics and the idea of eugenics and trying to create a super race of people. He was really quite convinced that it was kind of all in the biology there of people inheriting good intelligence or inheriting bad intelligence. And I actually don't think that he was a racist, the way that we would kind of look at racists today, but he did have these beliefs, and there are a lot of people who have come after him who have kind of found ways to fit the science to fit that that view. And it really turns out not to be true. Not to say that we don't have genetic differences and that we don't have genetic advantages and disadvantages and intelligence and all these different things. We're not all born exactly equal or anything like that. But fundamentally, if you look at what intelligence is, it's an accumulation of skills. And this idea that we're each born with a certain IQ level that was just kind of right in our genes, and there's nothing we're going to do to change that, and we can't go up and it can't go down, and if we're born with a mediocre IQ, just kind of so be it. That's just fundamentally wrong. We can become intelligent. If you know how to become, if you can figure out how to become inspired, or your parents can, or teachers can figure out how to inspire you, it's going to make all the difference in the world. If you realize that intelligence is a series of skills that you want to tap into the process of building rather than this innate stuff that you either have or you don't have, you actually become more ambitious and more successful if you realize that that's the true paradigm.
And so you've mentioned parenting, you've mentioned teaching. You have an interesting section in the book on the kind of parenting that can actually nurture the development of intelligence and of talent, and the kind that tamps it down. Narcissistic parents, for example.
Yeah, well, narcissistic parents actually do have the ability to create some pretty extraordinary young prodigies, but the problem is the expense, and the expense is that they are destroying, they're creating emotional time bombs, because what happens so often, there's a psychiatrist in my book who calls it the Britney Spears syndrome. Parents send the messages one way or another to their young child that the way to earn their parents' love and acceptance and favor is to work hard at this particular discipline. And that is a very destructive equation. You don't want to withhold love or approval of your child pending their work or intensity in some level or another. It can lead to a short-term payoff, but a long-term disaster.
Yet Beethoven is an example of just that thing, isn't he?
Well, Beethoven went through an excruciating process, and it's really very sad. We know that Beethoven obviously became an extraordinary composer, and early on he was a fairly good performer, a musician. He was essentially tortured by his parents. I mean, the practice that he was physically forced to go through as a very, very young boy would leave him absolutely miserable. And we have firsthand reports of this. And I don't think that any of us, any parents listening out there, certainly not me as a parent, want anything like that for our kids. And if that's the only way to become great at something, of course, we don't want that. But fortunately, the message is that's not the only one way to become great. The really important and honest and progressive message for parents is teach your kids how to respond to failure. Show them by modeling in your own life that, yeah, you have disappointments every single day. And the more ambitious you are, the more disappointed you're going to be in not being able to achieve a specific ability or skill or achievement of some sort. But that your response to that failure is not to say, oh, that reflects some sort of inner, you know, fixed limit of me, but no, just the opposite. Say no. That's revealing a skill I don't yet have. It's revealing something I haven't quite yet mastered. I'm going to get up tomorrow and I'm going to master that skill, and then I'm going to move on to the next one. And that failure really is has to be much more seen as a friend than an enemy. And that is really the key insight. If you look at all the great super achievers out there, they turn failure into your friend.
And I'm speaking with David Shank. His book is The Genius in All of Us. It's about how talent is more developed than inborn. You say, for example, that we shouldn't actually praise accomplishment so much as effort in our children.
That's right, because it's all about the process. And ultimately, if we are ambitious in our lives, which I believe we should be to at least a certain degree, we're never going to get the ideal. Very few of us are going to be the absolute best or going to win that, you know, Nobel Prize or Pulitzer or whatever it is, or be hung on, you know, in the most prestigious museum in the world. But we can get pretty darn good. And the way to do that is to find a process that has meaning to you, that actually involves disappointments, as I said, daily, even from hour to hour. But that there's a certain satisfaction in pushing yourself to the limit of your ability and then just beyond, and then trying to figure out what it is you're not quite able to do and why, and push yourself and develop a certain satisfying process. There's a psychologist, Anders Ericsson, who really helped create this whole new field of expertise studies, and he calls this process deliberate practice, and he's contrasting it with ordinary practice. Ordinary practice is where you go out on the golf range and you hit some balls and you're more enjoying yourself. You're just kind of more seeing what you can do and just being disappointed in what you can't do, but just kind of doing it for the enjoyment of the process. Deliberate practice is when you are deliberately pushing yourself to do what you can't yet do. You're pushing yourself right to the edge of your ability and then a step beyond. And it's not an easy process, and it's not a fun, relaxed process. It's a process of intensity and constant disappointment and constant kind of going back and back and back until you just raise your ability just that one tiny bit level forward, and then you push yourself a little bit more. And then every day you're going back and you're saying, all right, let's see what I can't do today and try to learn to be able to do part of that.
It sounds like you're describing a very natural process. In fact, the process by which children learn to walk, talk, that this is innate and that the satisfactions, you know, it's genetic.
Well, it absolutely does mirror the lives of young children. And in fact, one of the insights in the book that I just stole from someone else is to say that parenting is really about modulating the failures of children. I mean, when you think about it, children are born able to do almost nothing, and then they start eventually trying to do stuff, and it's a series of failures. And you're there to find that balance between encouragement, but also not doing it for them, you know, putting them in a situation that's safe, of course, physically safe, and emotionally safe, where they're encouraged to try something, and when they fail, you're, you know, there to console them and to encourage them and to say, you can do it, and your older brother, you know, just did it, and here's how it's done, and we're going to get there eventually. And all these things, walking and talking and all the basics in our life are really achieved through that process. And at a certain point, you grow up, and because you're entering the realm of more optional skills like playing golf or basketball or violin, you know, most of us don't push as hard in our lives as we did when we were learning to walk and talk and read and things that are seen as just fundamental to all of us. And so we kind of back off that intensity, and it's the super achievers in life who never really back off that intensity. You kind of take that same early intensity and apply it to these more optional skills.
Yeah. Finally, I'd like to ask you about the autistic savant, because it seems to me this is a very different kind of a case. Here you have people who, in some way, one part of their brain does not function very well, and other parts of the brain do, but they're not necessarily being pushed by their environment to develop a certain skill. They do it themselves. How does this whole process work, and how does that fit into your ideas of the development of talent?
Okay, well, I have a whole chapter on this, but it actually does fit, although it seems counterintuitive to what I'm saying. You're right. And it's true that savants are, if not genetically determined to be to have these very severely deficient brains, there's something in the very, very early development that happens to their brains where, as you say, a piece of the brain is essentially not working right. And as a consequence, they develop just a different way of doing things and going about things. And the focus in their lives ends up being very different from the average person's focus. Now, the key point there is that the abilities that we see them develop, these extraordinary memories or this extraordinary ability to paint or draw something in detail or hear something, you know, play it on the piano and then just kind of mimic it back with incredible accuracy. These are actually skills that are developed over time. They're not stuff that just kind of happens to them. And they're skills that they're able to develop because their brain has a certain focus. And what's interesting is that there have been a bunch of different experiments on ordinary brains, ordinary people with ordinary brains that have mimicked that whole process. That is, they found a way to kind of temporarily disable certain sections of the brain. And over a period of time, you actually see those people developing a process of developing what looks like savant-like skills. They don't just kind of pop into view as soon as you shut off a part of the brain. It's a new way of kind of seeing the world and a focus that then pushes you in a direction of having this extraordinary memory or drawing in this, you know, incredibly accurate way. And so again, what we see is we see that all of these skills are actually developed in a process. It doesn't mean that we're exactly equal. You know, genes are very much influence us in our differences, but it does mean that in terms of developing skills, it is a matter of development, and the skills themselves are not there just sitting hidden in our genes. Our genes, in fact, and our brains are actually designed to respond to environmental demands, and that's what leads to extraordinary abilities.
David Schenk, your book is The Genius in All of Us. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
You can hear David Schenk reading an excerpt from The Genius in All of Us at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with David Chura about his sensitive memoir of teaching kids in adult jail, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our last guest, David Schenck, told us our environment has a greater impact on our lives than our genes. That's something our next guest, David Chura, would agree with. He spent 10 years teaching students being held in adult jails for crimes ranging from drug sales to assault. Chura says the war on crime is all too often a war on kids, ignoring the environment in which children were raised. The young men he taught were victims of abuse, poverty, and neglect. Yet, despite their histories, they're capable of compassion, enthusiasm for learning, and joy. Chura brings their stories to life in his book, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine. David Chura, welcome to Writer's Voice. In your book, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, the subtitle is Tales of Kids in Adult Lockup. First of all, tell us about this place that you taught in.
I taught at a county jail, an adult county jail, and it was in Westchester, New York, which is a suburb of New York City. So it was a fairly affluent, heavily populated area. And the students that I taught were between the ages of 15 and 21. They were high school students. And I was there for 10 years as a high school teacher. So it was a five-day-a-week, you know, 6 or 7 hour a day teaching job. And these were young men and women who had been sentenced to do time in an adult jail.
And let me break in there and ask you, why were they sentenced to do time in an adult jail? Weren't these children?
Yes, I think that one of the issues that is constantly raised in juvenile justice is the idea that these are young people, these are children, and that the way the laws stand in many states, they are being tried as adults and then often sentenced as adults. What they were there for was sometimes as simple or small as trespassing or loitering or cutting school. I mean, that said, they were also had a background of being involved in the criminal justice system. And many of them were there because they actually started out as children, not in the jail, but they started in the criminal justice system because of their parents. They were in the family court because of what parents had done, then probably went to foster care, group homes, so that they were some young people that were, as you would say, kind of in the child welfare system. So that by the time that perhaps they got locked up because they had been cutting school too much or trespassing, they had sort of a whole file that was following them. But they were very much, in many cases, there because of what had happened to them before in terms of what their background was. Also, there were young people there that had been involved in drugs, very often just using drugs. And in New York State, they had very draconian drug laws. They ended up being locked up for things that really wouldn't necessarily warrant them being in such a serious situation.
Give us an example of that.
There's a young man I write about in the book named Anthony, and he was this 17 years old. He had been living in an institution, a very large child welfare institution, and he was developmentally delayed. And this was a young kid who, although he was always kind of getting in trouble, he always stayed on the right side of the law, unlike many of his friends. And he one day was at the county mall, and the two guys that he was with decide to rob the purse of a woman. And he kind of went along with it, using very poor judgment. And they snatched the purse, and as they were running away, they threw the purse to him. And he was apprehended by the police. And the three boys were all arrested. And the police said that there had been a weapon and no weapon had ever been found. So now he was going to be in the county jail. He was in the county jail and he was waiting to be sentenced because the charge was pretty serious. They felt that it was sort of an armed robbery. And added to that was the fact that the person that they robbed was the wife of a policeman. And at the same time, in Westchester County, there was a district attorney who is no longer there, who was really running on the tough on crime. So she would do absolutely no plea bargaining. She would always go for the heaviest sentence. So despite the fact that this was a young man who was developmentally delayed,
had no prior record,
And even though our social worker, we had a really wonderful social worker on our school staff, intervened for him and sort of talked about the extenuating circumstances and could he possibly do whatever sentence in the county jail where he would have a little bit more, it would be smaller and a little bit more protection. This was a young man that got sent away for 5 years in state prison. I mean, he was terrified. He was 17 years old and he was going to state prison, and a kid who just had no social or mental abilities to deal with that.
You talk about the war on crime, of which this is a prime example, as being a war on kids.
Yeah, I think that when I started working in the jail, which was around 1995, there was a real, it was kind of the beginning. The 90s was the beginning of this sort of tough on crime, war on crime. And a lot of the things that you would see in the media and you would see in the local papers and things like that was that the focus seemed to be on scooping up lots of kids off the streets. And they would talk about sweeps. They would talk about drug sweeps or you know, guns or whatever it happened to be. And it was at that time when there was this whole upsurge of getting tough on crime that there was a political scientist who wrote a very influential article. It was called the Advent of the Super Predators. So he was the one who put forth this term, super predators. And he talked about a sort of a surge of young people that were coming along that were just totally remorseless, would do anything. They committed crimes for pleasure. And he was predicting that this was going to get worse. And this kind of fed this idea of the war on crime, and that's why we have to get tough, and that's why we had to have mandatory sentencing standards for particular crimes.
And mandatory sentencing is
when a judge has no, there's no leeway in terms of taking in, like in Anthony's case, taking in the situation of what were the extenuating circumstances. So you saw more and more kids being kind of swept up in this. And I had an interesting experience in that I had been reading about this wave of super predators in the New York Times and actually finding myself to be frightened also. And these were the kids that I had worked with in alternative education since the 80s and then in the jail in 1995. And I realized that how easy the public was frightened. And that's when a lot of states were passing laws saying lowering the age when a minor could be tried as an adult.
And lowering it from what to what?
18 used to be, you know, sort of the old 18. You can be drafted, you can vote, so you can be tried as an adult.
You can drink in many states.
Yeah, and many states lowered it to 17, 16, and in some states it goes to the crime, not to the age. And in Massachusetts itself, where I'm living now, is that it is still at 17. So that you have young people at 17 being tried as adults and serving time in adult prisons.
And what does this mean? You've been working with, or you had been working with kids this age, teenagers, for many years, as you said, first in an alternative high school and then in the jail. Just maybe briefly, kind of run down for us, what are the differences between the adolescent brain, let's say the adolescent level of development, and the adult? What's the argument for keeping kids out of these jails?
The whole research in terms of cognitive development, and it's been kind of interesting in the last, say, sort of 5 years, they talk about the development of executive abilities. And
tell us what that is.
Well, the ability to make decisions and to make them in a way that takes in all the information and can sort of control impulses. And I'm sort of intrigued by the fact that I have a variety of friends who have young people who are graduating from college, 20, 23, 24, 25. And now the data shows that that's the age when the executive functions kick in, are fully developed. These young people are living at home and taking their time getting a job because of a whole bunch of factors. But there's much more of an acceptance in our culture. But yet when you turn and you look at a 17-year-old who is many years away from the development of their executive functions, we're throwing the book at them. We're saying that you did this crime, you made this choice to rob that lady, to steal that car, to sell those drugs, and that they're going to be suffering the consequences of that action. So that on one hand, in a very middle class, educated population, we're okay with it. But when it comes to a disenfranchised population, and we haven't talked about the issue of racism in the jail.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you about that, because in your book, David Shura, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, you talk about being asked a question by one of the classroom corrections officers, a woman, who is a woman of color herself. And she asks you kind of skeptically, do you really think that the criminal justice system is racist? And in other words, she's implying that the kids are in there because they've done bad things.
This was a young CO, female officer, who I worked with, and she actually was very supportive of the young men that we had in class, and she herself was going to be a social worker. And she asked me the question, and at the time, I remember we were looking, it was a very quiet day in the classroom, and we were looking at a sea of faces of color, you know, all different shades of brown. And I didn't know what to say to her, because she was quite sincere and well-meaning. And my reflection was that the county that I was teaching in Westchester County, probably the minority population is about 14%. And the jail, and I don't have the exact statistics, but if the jail had to be 85 to 90% people of color, and when I first started, mostly African Americans, and it started to change to be a mix with different Latino groups. So the implication of just that, the difference between the statistics, made me feel like it was racist. The other issue is that so many of these young people didn't have the resources, whether it be family or money, to get a lawyer, post their bail, and basically work the system in the way a more educated middle-class family would help a child to do. And that whole issue of the racism, I think, is kind of an undercurrent. And even when this political scientist was writing his article about the super predators, he talked about the influx of African-American boys. So it really is part of something that doesn't really get addressed very often. Or if it's addressed, it's not addressed by the population that makes that has the influence on the legislatures to do something about this.
In your book, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, David Shura, you really bring out the individuals, the humanity, the human situation. You go way beyond the labels, and one really has a rich sense of the inner life of a lot of these kids. One of the most affecting stories is the prison birthday. In fact, I think it might even be the first one. Tell us about Ray and his life, where he came from, and why you chose to open the book with him.
Ray is a very affecting story. When I write about him in the book, he's just turned 21. So he's having his 21st birthday in jail. And over the 10 years that I was there, it was really interesting to me how any birthday was kind of a reason to celebrate for these young men, because so many of them had seen people that they loved, their friends, their family, killed on the streets. And they would talk about it, and I found it very disturbing, that they had no idea that they could possibly live past the age of 25 or 30. And they said it with somewhat of a fatalistic, that's the way it is. So Ray, the day of his 21st birthday, comes in and asks me if he could draw basically a timeline of what his life had been like. And he loved sort of math and graphics, so I said, fine. And so he gets his ruler and he starts drawing this out. And as he's setting up this timeline, he tells me the story about each event that happened. And for Ray, his life started at age 5 when he was taken away from his mother because she was a drug addict. And he kind of recounted the family members he stayed with, the foster homes, the group homes. His dad had done time in Attica's prison in New York. So you're talking about some pretty heavy-duty crime. Until he actually was living on the streets. And Ray also ended up sort of becoming involved in drugs himself. But what was so striking to me was that he knew each event that had happened to him that was significant. And it might be the aunt who, when his father had to go back to prison who takes him, but also locks, what she does is she gets paid by his father to take care of him, every night locks him in the bedroom, gives him a bucket to pee in and a thing of water. And this is the way he's treated. And the thing about this kid is that I was always struck by he was not bitter. There was not none of the rage or anger that I think would be many people would feel. He was very hurt by that. And he was hurt even further when she kicks him out at Christmas Eve. And as I write in the book, it's not that she totally abandoned him. She still was collecting his Social Security check, his disability check. And he talked about being raped when he was 11. He then did some staying in psychiatric hospitals. So that he had this whole, the image I use in the book is that if it was a graph, it would be a downward turn. There would be nothing that was sort of up about it. He then kind of talks about having met a drug dealer and how this drug dealer was the only person who was ever kind to him and took him in. And indeed, he lived with the family for 5 months. The man did not involve him in drugs or selling of drugs. And then eventually that man got in trouble and he disappeared. And so Ray was again on the streets. And that's the time that I met him, was that he was back in jail. And his comment was that after he had done the whole graph, his comment was that he had lived free, as he said, not in any place locked up, for probably a total of 6 years and several months of his whole life. And I took the title of the book from something that he said. He just sort of said, I don't wish nobody to have a life like mine. And at first it sounds like sort of a bitter statement, but I was always struck by this kid's compassion. And there was this element of, he knew it was bad, and he just didn't want people to have to go through the kinds of things that he had gone through.
And we're talking with David Chura about his book, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, Tales of Kids in Adult Lockup. A lot of the kids in your book, I was actually struck by their compassion. And for example, there's a story of Darkwell, and you mentioned mental illness, or that the kid that you just talked about had been in a psychiatric facility. Well, Darkwell is also, and he's a kind of very strange kid. It seems to maybe hear voices. He's just really an odd man out, somebody who might really be tormented in a normal high school, and even, of course, in a place like yours. But the kids don't do that to him. Tell us a little bit about him and why they tolerate him.
Darkwell was actually a kid that I was really haunted by because of his experience. When he came to class, I think he was 18 or 19, I think maybe 17 or 18, and he had been admitted to the jail. He was in what they call the forensic unit, so it was kind of the mental health unit, and they were trying to adjust his medication. And he hadn't come to school at first, but the psychiatrist talked to me and said that he wanted him to kind of get back into school and start to have some kind of normal experiences. But his warning was that this was a young man who had this constant sort of smile on his face and giggled inappropriately. And this was a response to the fact that he was hearing voices. And there was a lot of just bizarre thinking that went on. And Darkwell's background was, in a way, similar to Ray, is that he had been abused by all kinds of family members and abandoned by the family and had been in and out of institutions. And the psychiatrist felt that part of what happened with him was a lot of his delusions and his voices were regarding sexual matters, and that he felt that this kid had been, you know, sexually abused, pretty basically assaulted. So Darkwell comes, and he's got the grin, and he's doing this sort of the giggle every once in a while. And in jail, I was always struck by the tolerance of the young men that I worked with for what we would call aberrant behavior. Not that there wouldn't be a time when, if somebody was having a bad day, that somebody would victimize another person. I don't want to paint a picture that everybody was always tolerant. But there was this feeling, I think it was a two-level thing. I think on one hand, these guys were smart enough to know when you just stay away from somebody because you don't know where it's going to go. But there was also a sense of compassion because I think they felt that he was pretty harmless. The other thing that struck me in that occasion was that the officer that I worked with was a really, really hard-nosed, took no crap from anybody kind of person. But he had such a tender spot for this kid and made it really clear to the other guys, leave him alone. We're going to just give this guy a chance. and see how he goes.
In I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, David Chura says the system that puts kids into adult lockup damages everybody, not just the kids, but also the corrections officers who are charged with guarding them. I asked Chura if the system had damaged him as well.
Yes, and I can say that somewhat unequivocally, because two things alerted me to this. That in the beginning of my teaching at the jail, I was very focused. I was had a lot of energy, and I was also able to do a lot of my writing at the same time. So I was working and I was writing, and I would use my summers to write. And I found that as time went on, I would have less creative energy to do the writing, because being in the system and essentially on a day-to-day basis absorbing the kinds of things that you have to absorb, the security checks, the very passive-aggressive, abusive behavior of COs. I mean, you're walking down a hall, and the only way you can get to the next hall is you have to stand at a gate and wait for somebody to buzz you in. And you're standing there, and not an uncommon thought is, you know, that you're invisible. No, you know, and I've had experience of standing there for 10 minutes just waiting, knowing that the video camera is working, knowing that I can be seen, and then somebody just gets around to buzzing you in. So that's a very minor thing. But after a while, and the noise, jails are very noisy places. There's just dysfunctional PA systems and clankings and shoutings and screamings. And, you know, I'd be in my classroom and I'd hear suddenly just all this running and screaming and no idea what was going on. And, you know, I'd go on teaching, you know, simple versus complex sentences, you know, and or having a young man pulled out of a class and then being, you know, put against the wall and searched and having to go on as though nothing had happened. So those are the kinds of things. Over time, that really does kind of wear you down. And I think for me, part of the book was recognizing that whole journey of what was happening to me and what I was realizing, and that it was actually a very good thing for me to realize that this is what it feels like to be in this kind of environment over a long period of time. And I felt very blessed in that I had my education and my philosophy as a teacher to kind of carry me through this experience. When I finally left the jail, which was after 10 years, and part of it was that I knew that I didn't have the energy to continue absorbing the craziness, because it's just a very crazy system, and also wanting to continue to do my writing. When I left, I was very struck, and continue to be, and it's been three years now, that I would have nightmares. I would get a tightness in my stomach when I would think about it. I would be in doing some research for various other things I was writing about jails. I would go to websites. I'd see pictures of cells, and I would just get this visceral reaction. And I really began to reflect on the idea of how much, if you work in that system, you have to put down in order to continue to do it. So I feel that there is a certain amount of, to use a current phrase, post-traumatic stress that has gone on with it. And I really reflect on what it means to be a kid in that kind of situation. Mm-hmm. And what the erosion of all resources that being a 17-year-old and doing 5 years in a state prison would do.
One of my favorite stories in your book, David Chura, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, is the one about Warren, a kid who never read a book until you gave him Man-Child in the Promised Land by Claude Brown. Tell us
the
story.
He was one of the spunkiest kids, because he came into class being one of the lowest readers that I had, and I pretty much always encouraged guys to read as much as they could. And my classrooms were often a mix of high level, low level. I just had to, you know, whoever came in, I would have to teach. So I had a library of books that I would lend out and have guys take back to their cells. And Warren and I were working on pretty low level stuff. And there was one day where I was giving out books, and guys were sort of checking things out and looking at things. And Warren usually on those days would kind of just ease himself out of the room with the understanding that, you know, I didn't press any books on him because I knew that what I had at his level he would feel sort of embarrassed by. So we kind of had this quiet contract. But this day he stuck around, and for some reason he wanted to leave the room with a book from the pile. And so he went through a whole bunch of different books, and, you know, he didn't like one because it was about, you know, a black athlete, but then he didn't like another one because it was about a white mountain climber. I mean, nothing seemed to really capture his attention. And he had one friend in the class who was very protective of him, and he recommended Manchild in the Promised Land, which is a really wonderful urban classic. And it's amazing to me that kids still today will read it and be totally intrigued by it. So I often had multiple copies because it would kind of disappear. And so his friend Frankie said, "Why don't you try reading this?" And he said, can I take it? And I said, sure. And I really felt that it would leave the room and that would be it. But he somehow got hooked. And I so much clearly remember the next day that he came in, and that he had the book and he had a bookmark, he had read. And Warren was one of those kids who read word by word by word, and it was a very slow and what felt to me like an excruciating process. But he ate the book up. And he so identified with Claude, the narrator, that he would get bent out of shape if he did something that he didn't feel that he should have done or didn't understand why people treated him a certain way. And his triumph was that it was the first book he had ever read in his entire life. And you're talking about, I think he was 17. And I could still, the joy, I mean, the fact that he, and again, going back to one of your questions about the tolerance of these guys with each other, there was this feeling of celebration when he finished it. They were kind of proud of him. And Warren was somebody who was not easy to like because he was always getting under your skin and, you know, driving the other guys crazy. But they slowly really saw that this was really an amazing experience. And he finished the book, and I tried to encourage him to write a letter to the author because I had heard that Claude Brown sort of would respond to young readers in particular. And he really did not want to do it because he just felt, going back to the Children of Disappointment, that he didn't articulate this, but the message really was, you know, I've been disappointed enough in people, so I'm not going to set myself up, and I'm not going to write this guy a letter because he's not going to write back to me. And I cajoled him to finally write the letter, and he did. And then when I made that final suggestion of, oh, well, maybe he'll write back to you, I could tell that I had sort of sealed the fact that the letter wasn't going to get sent because of that whole thing about the disappointment, and he wasn't going to do it. But I was always struck by that triumph of having read that book. And I think it shows that kids, I think every story for me was one of resilience, that something pulls them through an experience that so many of us with our resources would be pretty crushed by.
David Chura, your wonderful book, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine. Thanks so much for coming in to Writer's Voice and talking with us about it.
Thanks so much.
David Chura. You can read an excerpt from his book at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.